Hi.
Hello.
Good to see you, Pete.
Good to see you, man.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. We got a tape again used. I forgot to, again,
notice that. You always forget to bring the stuff.
Yeah. But it's
fun. Almost like you don't care about life.
I don't. No, I do. I do. I do.
Just
if I say it enough, it'll feel real. It'll feel like I mean it. This is the Fundamentalist Podcast, everybody. Welcome back. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with Peter Rollins. We're going to talk today about the anxiety of language.
Oh, fantastic. You're bringing at least the idea.
Yeah. Love so it. This is a podcast where we discuss the possibility of life before death. That's a fun little way of thinking about it. It's about philosophy. Pete is a Northern Irish philosopher from Belfast, and you've written a bunch of books. You're a smart person.
Oh, thank you.
And I like to take what you say and make it sound like stuff that I came up with on my own.
Very good.
So the purpose of this podcast is to give folks who listen slash watch something that they can take and then talk about as an authority on that they are not actually authorities.
Yeah, which is well, that's all I do. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I just read Wikipedia. That's basically it.
Yep. Wikipedia, man, doesn't help with a lot of this stuff. Yeah. It's so I'm like, where's the juicy stuff?
But you know, there's more and more theorists on YouTube doing really good stuff.
I watched a little bit more of that, the plastic pills guy. Yeah. And I listened to a little bit of his podcast. I didn't quite understand it.
Yeah.
But it seems to be becoming a little bit more popular, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about this particular subject because I'm confused. And that's my favorite way to start one of these because it means that I hopefully will not be confused at the end of it. But what I've learned is typically I'm just more confused.
Yeah.
So, which is all tied into the theme. So basically the idea for this podcast came from me going, okay, I'm going to try to explain this. I get excited about it, and then I start trying to share it with people, and then I realize I get far enough along with it that I'm like, and there's the territory. It's just outside of me getting excited where I don't understand enough to talk about it. And so this particular subject is one that I'm confused by, and I think it's important because I think it's in everything because it's in language, and it's about how we speak. And my understanding is, so how about we do that? How about I'll give my, I'm going to do a big spiel.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to find the point at which, and you'll probably hear it, that I get, maybe you can have I wish you had a buzzer and you could buzz when I start saying something that's not according to the theory.
I'd be doing it very quickly.
Yeah. Oh, I know. That's a good, it's like the buzzer in the Taboo game. Did you ever play that game, Taboo?
I think I've seen it. Is that where you buzz every time someone makes a hesitation or a pause? No.
It's like they give you cards. You have to say a word, and you can't say the word to describe the word.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Excellent game for this theme. But here's how all this started of being a human and asking why. It started because we had the word why, and the word why comes from something we decided, a symbol we made up, all in an effort to try to communicate with one another. Because we needed to be able to communicate, we needed to be able to, in order to build a society.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. So when we created language, this is where it gets, we're going to get real into it.
Yeah.
When
this group of people were sitting around making language.
Yes. They're like, fellas, we got to come up with something called language.
Yeah.
And they're like, all right. What are we going to call it? So my understanding is any piece of language that we say, any word that we say, any act of communicating comes, it's like a combo meal, and it comes with a side of, instead of fries, a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of separation from what we mean and what we're trying to say and what we're trying to communicate. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, our entire lives, we develop something called the unconscious. We don't really develop it, I understand that, but there's this idea of the unconscious that's laced through everything that points to a lack within our being, basically, and in communication. And this is also when art and comedy and all these things become really fun, because they are an attempt to get a little closer or reveal something a little bit more than regular language can. So if you listen to a song and you get really moved by it, it's because it's doing something that the words themselves can't do on their own.
Okay.
And then we have all our problems.
Right. So, yeah. So
rip me apart.
Okay. So you're kind of basically, the question then is, right, how does language, what is language? How does it arise? When it arises, you're saying you, it's connected to something we can't say. That's what you're probably saying, is that every time we speak, there's something that we're not saying. There's always misunderstanding or impossibility built into language.
I think that's what I'm saying, but I also, even as you say that, don't understand what that means. So right. It's almost like how some, like anything that you look at, you know of in your brain inherently by the word that you've learned that is associated with that object, but it's only an association. It's only, the object is not the thing that you call it. It just is. And this is the type of conversation, by the way, that I think turns a lot of people off from philosophy because it's when you get into the world of what?
Well, we can make this all very clear. We can make it crystal
clear.
Great. 100%, right? So when I'm here, because you were using two words there interchangeably, which we could start looking at, which is communication and language.
Ooh, great.
So let's start by differentiating those two.
Okay.
Okay, so let's imagine, right, at some early stage in development, you see this in animals, communication starts. And one thing you can say about communication is communication communicates something.
Okay.
So you're under threat, the bird makes a certain sound. It wants to mate, it makes another sound, right? That's communication. And that's what computers do, they communicate.
Okay.
That's different from language. The idea, and we can pull this apart, in a second, but communication happens everywhere. Lots of different animals communicate. Language is a type of miscommunication. Language arises when you can say one thing and mean another.
Yeah.
Whenever what you say can have a multitude of interpretations.
Okay.
This becomes something different from just mere communication.
Because it's out of your control. Is that why? Or is it intentional? Like, are you talking about lying?
Well, yeah, lying. There's a particular type of lie that only humans can do, which is
the good kind.
The good kind. where you, this sounds weird initially, but it's where you tell the truth in order to lie.
Give me an example for this.
Yeah. Okay. So Lacan uses an example of like animals, right? If you're hunting an animal, you can look at its tracks and you can follow the tracks and kill it.
Okay.
And then there's probably some animals who are good at hiding their tracks, right? But what about an animal who is able to figure out that the hunter is very, very experienced? And so the hunter will see tracks and think that the animal is deceiving the hunter by making those tracks mm-hmm. in order to deceive the hunter. And so the animal keeps the tracks so that what they're doing is they're telling the truth. The tracks are telling the hunter where the animal is, but the hunter has worked out that the hunter will think that they're not real tracks and therefore there's a lie in the truth.
Okay.
And that's what human beings can do, that kind of weird, complicated stuff. And this is what you could talk about as the beginning of language. And It's just kind of obvious in everyday communication, there's miscommunication. In Twitter, everybody can misunderstand each other. You know, there's a constant ambiguity about language. And we can maybe start looking at where that comes from and what that is. So it's not mere communication. Human beings can communicate, but we're 9 times out of 10, we're not communicating.
Yeah.
We're speaking.
Speaking.
And that's slightly different.
Yeah, it's there's also such a, and this is a separate or slightly separate thing, but the feeling that one of the worst feelings for me, and I imagine most people, is that feeling of not being able to convey what is going on with the language at hand. And I think then you get into things like anger and like you like the emotional oomph that you put behind your language as a result of whatever, in an effort to try to communicate as much as you possibly can. And it's interesting that, like, I feel like now we're living in an era where, like, things like anger and or hate or yelling or just like are very like, you shouldn't do that. Like, don't get angry. Like, if you get angry, like, be nice, be cool, be whatever. But it seems like we're just putting a lot of like even more stipulations on being able to just talk freely and be, have people be like understanding of what you're saying. Because even when you do that, even when you do like incorporate as much of yourself into the communication as language as possible, you're still going to be lacking the full picture. No one can get in your head. Is that kind of the, like,
but also including you, because there's a weird thing where not only is there a frustration, if I'm speaking to you and I'm frustrated because I can't communicate what I'm thinking well enough, but there's also another side to that, which is I'm speaking something and think that I'm not making sense, and then you actually make more sense of what I'm saying than I know. So it happens both ways.
That's the best feeling. When you're like, it's like this, and then somebody's like, are you saying like da da da? And then you're like, yes, that's it's yes. Like, ugh.
Yeah. Okay. But it's almost like they're you kind of feel understood, but they also have kind of made the understanding. They haven't just kind of fed back to you what you said. They somehow kind of like in a very gracious way saw what you were saying better than yourself.
Yeah, they pieced it together. Yeah. Do you find that in your line of work and in like in your doing the seminars and the speaking, do you feel like it adds a certain level of does it make it worse, like knowing the inherent lack of clarity that's going to happen? Or do you feel under pressure when you're writing things to completely make sure that what you're saying is defined?
Yeah, no, I mean, you try to be as precise as possible, but this idea of the death of the author, that is the notion that actually people will hear things that you don't say or intend, and actually it might be better than what you say. So it's exciting to see how you can write something or say something and people will do something better with it. So it's kind of, it can be scary that I'm going to be misunderstood, or it can be exhilarating. You go, I'm going to put this stuff out there, and then someone who's smarter than me is going to think about it and actually going to see things and make associations and develop it in ways that I wouldn't have.
You're almost, you seem to be talking about this in like a more of a positive way.
Oh yeah.
So to be human is the great thing about being human is that you are, in your misunderstanding and vomiting it out, you can actually still be understood.
Yeah. Or things develop, like philosophy is a lot of ways is a creative misunderstanding of the people who came before you. Is somebody reads, Marx reads Hegel and then kind of misunderstands Hegel a little bit, but then that creates something positive. Or so there is this, history of philosophy can be seen as the history of creative misreadings.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I like that, creative misreadings. Yeah. So the reason, I guess, to get back to the core of this and why it's a subject, and that, I mean, it's going to be a little rambly because I'm trying to wrap my head around this. It was, the signifier and the signified and can you give me a rundown of what that actually means? Because in my mind, which is it goes back to what you're saying, I'll read those words and it's like I don't understand what they mean, but I can hear context clues and I can kind of figure it out. But in by my guesstimation, the signifier is fancy pants language for language or word or whatever. Like it is the box of language that you put a thing into.
Yeah, signifier is the sound or the shape of a letter. It's the signifier is like whenever I say tree, it's the sound tree. That's the signifier. And the signified is the concept that arises when I say that word.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. So Saussure, he was kind of the basically inventor of linguistics. Talked about a sign as having two sides, two parts, a signifier and a signified. And so like tree, again, the sound tree is the signifier and the concept of a tree is the signified.
I think it's so funny how so much of this is like, it just sounds like a meditation class, because in meditation classes, they'll be like, or whatever that exercise is, where it's like stare at a tree and try to understand that it's not a tree. Yeah. And you're like, try to wrap your head around the idea that it is that thing or whatever, like just take it in and acknowledge it, but don't try to put something on it is like part of that whole world. And it does seem to tie in a little bit to this thing, because you're learning to differentiate between
the signifier and the signifier.
Yeah, and the thing about that is that's bringing a third thing in, because then there's the tree that's really out there. So like Saussure isn't really talking about that. He's actually going, a sign doesn't even include what's in the world. But you're right that there's the third thing, is there's the things that are in the world, and then there's the sign and the signifier. So there doesn't have to be any trees in existence. We can imagine a world where there were no trees. So
we're getting there.
Apocalypse, yeah. And yeah, but we'd still be able to have a sign called tree.
So the signifies, the idea in your head, the ability for us to implant an image in somebody's mind. It's like the I'll get told that I need to get out of my head a little bit. Like I'll get too in my worked up about something. But the moment I remember that I need to get out of my head, there's no getting out of my head. It's like don't think of a pink elephant.
But, yeah.
And it's funny that we can, the power that we have to just be like, to just take control over somebody's brain and imagination just by being like, this thing, don't think of that. And then you're like, no. It's really funny. So that's all we have for today, guys. Thank you very much.
So then Saussure's big insight was that language is like chess, in a way that the pieces on a chessboard, it's not the shape, it's not what they look like that defines what the piece is. Technically, if I lose a pawn, I can take out a penny and use a penny as a pawn. What defines the moves of a chess game is where it's situated at the beginning, is the rules, the logic of the chess game.
The whole thing,
So Saussure is saying that a tree is just an arbitrary sign. It's just a sign. It could be anything. But what makes it a tree is that it's not other things. It's what makes it what it is its relationship to other words, other signs. And so just like a chess set, language is no word captures something. Words become meaningful purely in relation to how they're placed, in what they're placed beside. And the reason why that's important is because if you start to think like that, you start to see why language is slippery. Because depending on the context and depending on where a word is in a sentence, it can change its meaning and it can be reinterpreted in the future and in different ways. So when you get into language, you get into language is basically like a dictionary. And in a dictionary, every word just points to another word, right? So literally every word in a dictionary just points to other words.
Yeah.
But through that chain of what's called signifiers, a chain of signifiers, signification happens, meaning arises. But it's to do with this weird way in which words are interacting with each other.
That's some heavy stuff. What do you think about, I think, pretty normal relationship with the idea of most political correctness, mm-hmm. in the sense of being like, if there's a language that I'm supposed to use or not use for the sake of the way someone feels, I'm all fine about it. I'm guilty of not, I don't seek it either, because it's like the messiness of it and the offensive nature of language, I guess, if you view it this way, is inherent to kind of the whole thing.
Yeah. So people, all of us, I think, to some extent, we want to overwrite language with communication. So, you know, we want to basically make language into communication. In fact, we even think that language is communication. And if we go back to that earlier definition, communication is basically where you are able to say something without ambiguity, mm-hmm. right? So the sound and the message completely are one with each other. We kind of like fantasize that language is like that or can be like that. And therefore you get into purity cultures of language where, and the funny thing is, the more you play into it, the worse it gets. So the more you try to find a language of purity, the more that culture will potentially start to eat itself.
Yeah.
And because you can't find the pure discourse, you can't find a way to what Derrida would call basically stop the slippage, stop the slippage of language. Because language by definition is basically a chain of what he calls difference.
Is there a connection? It's almost like the we've talked about on this before, the like the revolution idea of a lot of political things and sort of the utopia idea, like one day we'll get to whatever if we X, Y, and Z and everything's going to be perfect. And I think there's a like a nihilistic thing there where you're like, oh, well, are you saying that because we can never live in a perfectly harmonious society that we should just give up because there's no point? And I feel like the idea is that no, you know, which I talked a little bit about in the solo Valley cast, but like fighting for, so this is actually, I hate to, it's almost like defending the political correctness thing a little bit, which I'm not really intended to do, but just for fun.
Yeah.
And I don't mean political correctness in the sense of like, I'm not trying to offend it, but you know, you people get it. It's like the, you know, the popular idea of political correctness where it gets a little whatever. Like I can understand the motivation behind it because it's like, try to make things in a way or speak in a way that is accurate to the person that you're speaking to. But holding that knowledge the entire time, I think, is so good for having some humility in it and having some just like, you know, like I'm gonna, it's like if I call someone by the wrong pronoun or something, I'm pretty quick to be like, you know, I don't give myself too hard of a time about it because I know that I'm going to mess up 10 minutes later anyway. So it doesn't, or mess up the next day with someone else in some other different capacity. So there's a curiosity there that I like, but there's always, I feel like it's easier to navigate this type of world that we're living in if you inherently understand that like, you're going to mess up and you're like, there's always going to be something that you're not able to incorporate or that you're leaving out or that you're throwing in that you don't mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, and the only thing to throw into the mix of this is that sometimes it can feel like there is a true thing that we can't express. And I'd want to kind of question that as in, it's not like that language always falls short in kind of like us communicating something. It's that there is no pure thing that language is missing. Like, that's kind of key, but you're right. There's a certain way in which, I mean, even take a word like, you know, you take a word like gay, you know, it's changed over time. To be gay was to be happy. And now to be gay is to, you know, to be gay or you know, homosexual, or whatever. Is that words change over time in history, but also words change in the moment. So you can say something and at the very end of the sentence, what you've said changes what was said at the very start of the sentence. So I could say something like, I really love the way that, I'm trying to think of a sentence, like a sentence where the first half of it is leading you in one direction, then the very last line is like the thing that twists the meaning.
Yeah.
Like, that's all comedy, to be honest.
I had a good, it's a misdirection. I had one of my favorite jabs that I've, lovingly thrown at Joe Beretta during your show was in a recent episode. We were supposed to give each other half compliments, and I said that he was such a funny YouTuber, and that kind of you are absolutely such a funny, funny YouTuber. And it's like the YouTuber part is meant to basically disqualify the idea that you can truly be that funny. And, I don't know. It was that idea of being like, I'm going to use this and I'm going to compliment you, but I'm going to do it in a way that just lowers the threshold. And no wonder it's like people quit Facebook and quit all those things and all the social media, because it gets to a point where you're like, I can't explain it. I don't know. I don't know how much I could keep going where it's like, this isn't going to, you know, someone's going to always. It also, though, I will say it helps deal with negative comments online, because you're like, yeah, of course. People are going to think that this is this or this. So
there's just there's an inherent messiness that cannot be cleaned up. And it's not that we don't want to try to communicate, but it's that that language is more than that. And actually that's what makes language so good. That's what actually makes it. That's what makes kind of poetry and advances things. To recap then, we've made because there's loads of other cool places we can go with this.
Yes.
But the first point is that language isn't communication, and that's why it's always a bit messy.
Okay.
That's why there's always slippage. That's why we can't we can never feel like we've nailed down language and can speak in a totally purified way.
Yeah, I think there's such a fun, it's cool too how there's like a whole world dedicated to trying to communicate effectively and trying to, it's like you pace and pace and lead with people. You agree with them at first. And you, one of my things that I've gotten really annoyed with lately is critique sandwiching or whatever it is when people you know, it's the compliment, here's a little note and then another compliment, because that communicates to me that in addition to whatever the critique is, that that person also wants me to feel good or wants me to not have my, not to feel bad about the thing. And, but I understand the, I do that. I'll be like, this is great. This part was wonderful. Maybe why it's, there's a politeness to it, but there's also at times a frustration because I'm like, just tell me what it is. But that's assuming that the other person even knows that. So the other person is opting to go, I'm going to be as nice as possible because I don't know where that person is. And there's, so it's already a lose-lose. And so, you know, it's like, it's just, it works. There's been times where I've done, I read that book, Start With Why, by Cynic, something Cynic. And I really liked it because it was about how if you start talking, if you begin with the why, 9 times out of 10, it helps people understand where you're coming from rather than be like, especially in political conversations, be like, well, I'm support this person because of like the broadest why that you can get to. And we were kind of talking about this a second ago when we were walking down there, because we were discussing a buddy of yours who I'm a fan of, and then someone who I'm a fan of who is a buddy of someone else I know, getting kind of lambasted for certain things that, you know, or a cancel or whatever, upset on the internet. And I don't want to go like, you know, too much into that, but one of the things we were talking about was going back to the core thing all the time of like why you do things, why you believe, like the purpose for the Valley Folk would be this, you know, the idea that we are friends who are going to make a business and make funny videos, make funny content, and then using that as a guiding light helps a lot, but it's still not enough. It still doesn't work all the time. And I can start with why, I can pace and lead, I can agree as much as possible, and my family's still going to be Trump supporters, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
But this is the reason why, like, so direct communication is kind of impossible, except for like, if you're highly autistic or something like that, you're getting close to that. Or there are certain people who find this slipperiness of language very frustrating. But for most of us, we know it. Like when you go into a shop and they say, what does they say in America? They always say like, are you having a good day? Or what is it?
How you doing?
You don't do that back in Ireland. And so the first time that I encountered it, it's like, yeah, thanks very much for asking. You know, you start a conversation with them as if it's meant.
I woke up at 7:30.
As an American know that that's not what it means.
Yeah.
Or the example in Ireland is you always refuse food twice and then you accept on the third occasion. So if someone says, are you hungry? Would you like something to eat? You always go, no. And they go, are you sure? No. And then the third time, go, oh yeah, please. Right.
Yeah. I learned about this when we started first. We're living together.
Is that? Yeah. And yeah.
I'd be like, you want something? She'd be like, no, I could never. And I'd be like, all right.
Yeah. That's the thing. Cause when I came to America and it was like, and then if you asked, they'd be like, why are you not asking me 3 times? Like, why did you just ask me once if I wanted a drink? That's ridiculous.
Why are you lying to me twice? Why do you lie to me twice?
So yeah, it causes us, because without even thinking about it, that's just the culture. You know what it means.
Yeah.
And so sometimes like people will find that kind of communication difficult, but we're doing it constantly. Even for example, if someone says, I want you to leave, they might actually want you to stay. But they can't say they want you to stay, because then you would stay potentially even if you didn't want to. They have to say, I want you to leave, so that you say, no, I'm not going to leave. I want to fight to stay. Mm-hmm. So basically you tell someone to leave in order because you desire them to stay. So we know this in language constantly, that not only is there slippage, but if I'm direct, I will always say more than I mean. So Slavoj Žižek uses the example in the academy, if you give a talk and I don't like it, I'll say it's interesting, right? Oh, it was very interesting, right? Which is basically code for I didn't like your talk. But if I say I didn't like your talk, you'd be like, You asshole. If you didn't like my talk, why did you not say it was interesting, right? Because to say it's interesting is to say I didn't like your talk, but in a polite way.
Yeah.
But to say I didn't like your talk is to say I think you're an asshole as well. So there's always this kind of moreness and lessness to language.
Saying I don't like your talk is like saying I don't want to be your friend anymore.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah, but I also kind of, I don't know, I was thinking the other day how fun, like there's a big gap that we don't talk about between being nice and being mean, where it's like the moment, at least in my experience, maybe it's an LA thing, but like there's a little bit of like the moment you aren't sicky sweet nice, you are inherently being mean.
Yeah.
But there is a type of directness that's pretty neutral, but it's hard to find that. Like, yeah, like the, like saying I didn't like your talk, that's an insensitive, rough thing to say. It's hard to hear that, and it's hard to process it.
Unless maybe you're a New Yorker, because that's the other thing.
Yeah.
Like different cultures, like an English culture is very polite. An LA culture is very kind of like overly nice.
Yeah.
A New York culture is quite aggressive. And so that's, again, why there's, I don't think there's a neutral right way to do it. It depends. Are you talking to someone from LA, from Northern Ireland, from New York? And where are you from? And that's why miscommunication happens so much, because there's no right way to say something. What there is various ways to navigate it in relationship, you know?
I think there's no one I, not know directly, but there's no one I like respect and admire and look up to in like my world, in the group of people I don't know, if that makes any sense.
Like, I hope you just stop there. There's nobody no I admire and respect in my world.
Yeah, and that's the button.
That's
title.
The takeaway.
I don't respect people, but like the people I do see doing the coolest things that makes me really excited, none of them, to my knowledge, don't have someone out there who thinks they're an asshole a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And I have found that when at times people thinking I'm an asshole is horrifying, because it'll be like really, you know, misunderstood. But there's other times where there's almost like a little bit of it when the directness inches a little out of niceness, because it's like the constant constraints of language are bad enough, but having to also put icing on everything and cupcake it a little bit for people is really frustrating for me. And so when I can get to a place where I don't feel encumbered, and I'm not trying to say I'm purposefully being an asshole, but when you can give up the go for more honesty, more authenticity, and as a result, it can come off a little harsh, it's so tough. It's like, I think the pendulum swung for me, where I was like, because I grew up in the South, and for language there, everything needs to be super polite, super like, you know, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, respect your elders. Like, you know, the elders will then in return be very stoic. Everything's fine for them. They won't complain. You know, Nate Bargatze has a great joke about driving in New York and how everybody just honks at each other all the time. Yeah. And he's like, that's how it should be in the South. If you get stuck at a stoplight, no one's going. You're like, all right, I guess I'll just stay here for the rest of the day. Go whenever you want. And like, that is kind of the South thing where it's like, I'm not going to get mad or show you that I'm angry. I'm going to let you just do your thing. And in New York, there's more communication because people are going, that's chaotic. So yeah, I don't know. It's a fun tightrope walk, I guess.
So this is what makes language interesting is like, this back and forth, and the fact that everything everything is overdetermined. That's what it means. So even the most communicative language, so communication being just like where the message and the medium are completely intertwined. So with scientific papers and philosophy is an attempt at communication. Even then, you can't get away from the language dimension. And this is where semiotics comes in, which is the study of signs and the study of meaning. That whenever
symbiotics,
semiotics, study of the sign, is where you know everything means things can mean more than they mean, and the study of that. So this isn't a bad thing, but language has this inherent undecidability. And then the question is, where does that, why? Where does that come from and how does that start? And I think that's an interesting question. If I say a couple of things about that, see where
please.
It goes.
Please. Yeah. I have something else, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, what are you going to say?
Well,
I might take it in a different direction.
It might take us in a different direction, which is the, it's really weird how we learn language and then that is the voice that we have in our head. So that's,
yeah.
It's strange that we, I can be aware of my thoughts. It's just the weirdest thing.
Oh, yeah. It's very
that's just strange. Yeah. It's very, you know what I'm going to bring up on this philosophy podcast? It's weird that we are. That's my
the
big,
fundamental philosophy question.
Yeah, yeah. You can tell I was prepped for this one. Yeah. I feel like I bit off more than I could chew, but it's so bonkers to me that you can have an intrusive thought, a full sentence, and be like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
I don't know where that come from. And then be like, okay, all right, I guess I'll just not do, the Kierkegaard thing of I can just take my car and drive off this cliff if I want, is crazy.
Yeah, and with the sense that we're in a way inhabited by language, we speak language, but often we're just speaking language. Like, yeah, as you say, like we're talking away and it can feel like, who is this saying this? You know,
right.
I'm
saying these words, but I feel like I'm flailing because I don't fully get it. So, all right, let's take it your direction because this is going to be way better.
Well, that connects with where I was going to go, actually. So a little bit about that is, the funny thing is the first time we obviously learn language from others, right? We imbibe it. We enter a world where speech is all around us and we slowly mimic it. And it kind of becomes part of us. But other people are always interpreting. Whenever you're a baby and you're crying, you don't know why you're crying, right? You might be hungry, you might be tired, you might be cold. But all you're feeling, because you don't even have words for all of that stuff, all you're feeling is, any metaphor doesn't work, but almost like explosions in your body. All there is is feelings. And then these people outside of you are interpreting that. And they're giving you language to that. They're helping you understand that. And so weirdly, you are learning about, you're learning what's going on in you from the interpretation of others. Other people are interpreting you and your existence and misinterpreting you, you know? And, you know, always swaddling you whenever that's not what you want. And these kind of things stay with us. These types of misunderstandings stay with us. So language is, we're constantly, the infant is immersed like in an ocean of words, coming to know themselves through what's being said about them.
Crazy.
And the first word, the word language really starts, one of the theories, I think the psychoanalytic theory is, language begins with a cut, with a prohibition, that there is a point at which the child is kind of like
no thank you,
destabilized. Was that
the point of the child where the child goes no thank you?
Yeah.
The point at which the child goes, the more I learn of this, the less I'm understood, I want to go back to baby town.
Well, yeah, although before that it's this somebody else's no, it's not the baby's no, it's an external no from the parent.
Oh, I see
it's
what
called
you're
a new of the father.
You need to light your cigar right now. This is where you're going full Freud.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes. This is where somebody says, called a new of the father, but it's not the father as such necessarily. But it's when something comes in and says, no, you can't be one with the world.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. There's that. Yeah. That's the language.
There you go. It's a no.
And you're steering away from the Oedipus stuff.
Yes, but it's
it is because people see your Oedipus stuff, they go, when you say one thing and mean your mother and blah 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 and the, you know, Electra complex or whatever, but really it is about a authoritative figure putting some kind of limitation on your desires.
Yeah. And
sense of oneness with everything.
Yes. And like for early on in the development, what all the child is learning is when they can eat, when they can shit, when they can go cry or whatever. Like when you're an infant, you're the first thing you're learning is rules, basically. You're being, you know, but the very first rule, the very first prohibition is, you know, you can't you can't be one with your mother or the primary caregiver. You have to
You're out here now. You're right, a separate thing.
Yes, you know, the primary caregiver has other desires and other needs, and while they love you deeply, you can't, you have to carve your own space in the world.
Which is obvious, but when you really think about that from a dumb baby's perspective, it would kind of be the only, it would be the first time it seems like where there is a formation of a little bit of self. Because yes. there's has to be in order to differentiate between distance from mother, from what, from the perfect comfort that they had before.
And so this is the injection of lack, right? So language, the first word is no, right? This is it's interesting that the Hebrew Bible basically starts there, you know, the prohibition of the fruit tree, right? So the first word is no. And so first of all, that's lack, right? So it's not something positive. It's a lack. It's a you can't have. And it's a no that has ambiguity in it. Because as soon as you say, no, you can't have this, there's this dimension of that's what I want, right? There's suddenly an ambiguity and a desire is born. And if I take the analogy of lack, right, it's like this is the moment when some parent injects lack into the child. And there's three things can go wrong. One is the needle doesn't penetrate the baby, which means the lack doesn't go into the baby, and that's called psychosis.
And then that's okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say over encroaching or something like that. When the helicopter parent thing of being like smothering the child, basically.
Oh,
but that's not what you're talking about.
Well, that is, it kind of is. That prevents the lack. If there's no way for the child to feel separation, is that what a helicopter parent is? Yeah. Yeah. Then the lack doesn't get in. The injection doesn't get in.
And I guess a helicopter parent is more like a constantly worried about the kid's safety that kind of thing and all up in their business. But it's the same.
That's connected. If that happens really early on where they have to be there all the time, the child can't fall without them being caught
or cry through the night or not get what they,
then, you know, you're potentially, the injection isn't going to get in. And then that's going to lead to things like, basically, it means the lack is on the outside, but we can talk about that in a minute. But the second is the injection goes in, but it's not strong enough. So your body fights it, and that's perversion. And then the third is the lack goes into your body, and that's neurosis.
You're neurotic, yeah.
But the funny thing is, this is the thing I was actually going to talk about today when we were talking about what we wanted to look at, is the difference between lack and loss.
Okay.
Because loss is at the conscious level, right? You feel you've lost something you desire, right? Desire is for something you don't have, right? And you go, I desire something, I would like something, whether it's a holiday or a cup of coffee or a person.
Right.
Lack is something that isn't, but there's nothing that can fill it. So loss kind of can be satisfied. Lack can't be satisfied, and it's unconscious. You're not conscious of it, it's unconscious. And that's drive. So desire, in our everyday lives, we desire things. But unconsciously, we have this drive that always subverts things. So
it's like, I'm glad we're talking. I'm sorry if this is not subject. But I desire a cheeseburger from McDonald's.
Yeah.
And the reason I desire it is because I'm hungry and I'm craving it and I grew up with it and it gives me comfort.
Yeah.
So I go to get my comfort food and I go through the drive-thru and I eat it. And for a second, I'm like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I needed. And then that feeling goes away because what I'm doing is I'm trying to satisfy a lack that is unconscious and therefore cannot be satisfied by this thing, by this burger.
Yeah, well, it depends. So if you're just eating the burger because you just want the burger, that's just desire, that's fine. If you become addicted to, say, McDonald's and you're always eating it and then it looks like you're trying to eat the burger. There's some sort of lack that's underneath that's a problem. But a great example of this is a myth from Greek myth, the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. Can I tell you that?
Please do.
Basically, Orpheus and Eurydice were deeply in love. married, but it was short-lived. There's a prophecy that something would go wrong. And sure enough, Eurydice is bitten by a snake, dies instantly, goes into the underworld. So Orpheus, who's half god, goes, I'm going to go into the underworld and I'm going to bring Eurydice back. And he risks everything, goes into the underworld, which would kill any mortal. He seduces, basically tames Cerberus, the three-headed dog, through the plane of a lyre, which he has. And he eventually meets Hades. And he convinces Hades to give him Eurydice back. And Hades says, well, okay, I'll give you Eurydice, but you have to perform one last task. And now Orpheus has already gone into the underworld and done this incredible task. So, you know, he can do anything.
Yeah, I'm a good boyfriend. Chill.
Yeah,
fine.
Sacrificed everything. And so he's waiting for something big. But Hades says, all you have to do is walk out of the underworld. Eurydice will follow you. And as long as you don't look back, you will have her. She'll go out. But if you glance back, she'll be taken back into the underworld forever. And so as you can probably guess, a few feet from the exit, Orpheus loses confidence and wants to check to make sure Eurydice is behind him. So he glances back. He sees her and, of course, sees her being pulled back into the underworld forever. Now, the surface reading of that story is that Orpheus is just an idiot. Right? He's just not patient or whatever, but obviously that's not a good interpretation, right? the insight of the story,
dummy, yeah, just follow rules,
just do it, it's easy. But the more interesting reading is, oh, this is the difference between desire and drive, right? At a conscious level, he desires Eurydice and he wants to be with her, but unconsciously he somehow doesn't want to be with her, because then he can have the memory of the perfect relationship.
Yeah.
So what he has is this, and you see this in people's relationships, is sometimes they would prefer not to be with someone to keep the fantasy alive that that person would be the one, that it would be amazing if they were together. This is the difference between desire and drive, or loss and lack. In a person.
Yeah, you encouraged me at the beginning of Grace and I dating when I was reaching out to, because, and part of it was going, if I don't, I'm just going to keep having that, the idea that, oh, maybe we would work. But then I was like, the motivation was going, well, if I do this, it'll ruin the, potentially ruin the fantasy that I have. And so I was like, well, okay, I've had this, you know, this is, I might as well move on to the next fantasy. And so it was almost the motivation of going, this probably won't work. But even if it doesn't, at least the fantasy dies that got me to actually work up the gusto to do it.
Yes, absolutely. And like, if you get too caught up in the fantasy, then you can't have the relationship. Mm-hmm. And a relationship in some ways, and this is where it comes back strangely to language in a weird way, but is that, to have a relationship is to somehow bring loss and lack, or desire and drive, into relationship with each other. That there's a certain sense in which the reason why I say lack is unconscious is, weirdly, at an unconscious level, there is a pleasure in not getting. And you can see it with Orpheus. There's a pleasure in not having Eurydice. There's a pleasure in the lack. It's what gives Eurydice such value to him. So the unconscious is always sabotaging us, because that's what makes things valuable, right?
Yeah.
The relationship, actually what makes a person desirable or a cause desirable. But if they are, you know, if the unconscious is too strong in this, if the drive's too strong, then you can never have anything in life. You'll always sabotage. You'll never be able to embrace it. So this is kind of what language brings us into. Language brings us into a world of disappointment, but creative disappointment.
Yeah.
Like, that's where the fun is. That's where the enjoyable stuff is that, just like in language, there's a no whenever the first word is a prohibition, you can't have. And that makes us desire what we can't have. It gives value to it. Then what we do is that's what continually drives us in our work. And so maybe you're always going, how can I be better in my work? Mm-hmm. How can I do it better? And you'll never get to the end of that. But the constant failure keeps driving you to do better and better things. And so you continue to fail, but as you fail, you create more content and you create better mm-hmm. things, you know? Like I'm always thinking about, how do we make this podcast better? But the funny thing is that desire is what will hopefully one day make it half decent.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, we have the conversation with Valley Folk where it's like, we're at our best when we're being terrible business people, making bad business, when we forget the idea that we need to be a certain way and to do X, Y, and Z, then like the magic happens, but only when it's like getting back to the, just like, all right, let's just do this.
Yeah.
And then things happen. And it's so tough, man. No wonder people stay stuck in the worlds of like indecision and that kind of thing, because they like it. Why not? I mean, that was what it's like. Freud being like, the people who going to, I was talking to my mom on Mother's Day about this because she does counseling, and she was saying how she'll sometimes fire clients that she's a counselor for because she'll give them advice. She'll do her counseling thing and they won't take any of it. They won't do it. And she'll go, eventually she'll be like, you're wasting my time and you're wasting your own time. But we didn't really get too much into this, but in my mind, I'm going, that's what they want though. They're paying for the advice so that they don't have to listen to it.
And that is it. And that's the difference between counseling and psychoanalysis actually is. Because counseling is based on the idea that people want counsel or will take counsel. Psychoanalysis is based on the idea that there's something in us that doesn't want, that enjoys our own self-destructiveness. So technically, you know, psychoanalysis is always trying to unpick what we're getting out of it. There's basically two types of failure. There's the failure of never trying something, which is, and there's enjoyment in that, which is, I say I want to write a book, but I never get around to it because the fantasy of the book is always better than the reality of the book. And I'm more in love with the fantasy of it. But deep down, I know if I wrote the book, it would never be as good as I think. So I'm caught basically in the failure of not trying. And then the second failure is the failure in which you do write the book and it's not as good as you thought it would be. But you get enjoyment out of both of them, right?
Yeah.
But the second one is a better enjoyment. You can enjoy your enjoyment because there is a certain, like the trick is, how do I enjoy my failure? How do I move forward in life knowing it's not going to work, but enjoy that failure and realize that failure is productive. So then I'm going to write a second book. So in my work, I'm always trying to define what parotheology is. And I always feel every time I describe it or do a course, I feel like I didn't get it right. But that then generates my desire to do another course. And as I do more courses, the idea begins to solidify. It becomes more meaty. It becomes stronger. It becomes better. So the constant failure to get where I want to go is both enjoyable and productive.
Yeah.
So
I love it, man. That's when you get into, and that is, it does seem to go back to the like disengaging from the promise, disengaging from the fantasy a little bit, that if everything changed, then something would happen. Or if you just could be less lazy and we could be, you know, finally buy a mic stand or whatever. And that's not to say that we won't buy a mic stand, but yeah, it's like, it's such a lighter, easier way to go through life. It's just so interesting that it also is tied to these really complex terms. Like I lost you a little bit earlier when you were talking about all the different words you were throwing out. I don't remember what it was, but that's probably for the best.
Yeah.
But I like that story. I like it's very similar to the Lot's wife, you know,
looking
into
back
salt. And I never really thought about it from the perspective of, like wanting his wife to get sucked back into hell, wanting the tragedy more than like the thing, because being in the tragedy is somehow gives them juice.
Yes. And that's the, like in a fundamentalist we did, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? I mentioned the difference between the hypothetical imperative and the categorical imperative. And the hypothetical imperative is where we make decisions based on pleasure and pain, right? We, and all animals do this. We look at life.
Yeah.
We judge what will be better for us, what will be worse for us. We act accordingly.
What is safe, not safe.
Yeah. So that is not, and that's at the conscious level, entirely what we do. right? So that's where evolutionary psychology is right. Like we consciously we live in that.
But what there is a lizard brain in our us that keeps us, that reacts to everything as though it is going to burn us.
Yeah, and we are, like, in that sense, we are fully determined. We are, we're on a track, right? Choosing one thing and not another. But then at the unconscious, and this is where language comes in, is the idea that, the idea that the categorical imperative is something that we value so much that we think that we would do the action no matter, like we would die, we would sacrifice entirely for something. So now it's not utilitarian. It's something comes into the world that we believe is outside of all consequential values. That comes into existence through language, because when there's a prohibition, you can't have something. That gives the thing this profound value.
Okay.
And then you desire it more than just some sort of selfish thing. So this unconscious drive, this prohibition that enters life, is what makes life so powerful and so beautiful, and it sacrifices and all the worst things as well, where people will kill and destroy.
Yeah.
But the trick is not to get rid of the drive. It's not to get rid of this. It's about accepting and enjoying the inherent impossibility that is hard baked into language and into our lives. And if we can somehow enjoy that, and then, you know, we'll be able to
enjoy
it and have a meaningful kind of life.
Maybe grow and do more things.
Yeah. So that's the difference between the analytic cure and, say, you know, maybe chemical cures, is that a lot of people are saying the cure is to get rid of the drive, to get rid of this sense of dissatisfaction, to try to unplug from the world or enjoy what you have and not strive. This is saying, no, what we want is creative maladaptation. We want to be positively maladapted to the world, to enjoy not being at one with the world. So instead of all of these people on social media promising that they can make you happy, as in to stop desiring and to kind of fully feel integrated and adapted to the world.
Yeah.
This psychoanalysis is about saying, how can you enjoy your maladaptation? And this is connected to the symbolic realm language, which never gets what it's trying to describe. There's something inherently frustrating about language. We'll never say exactly what we think we want to say, but that's what creates new language. That's why young people come up and create new, like, words, new ways of speaking, because the old ways of speaking don't quite communicate something. So there's something very profoundly productive about this evolutionary process.
Man, it's so fascinating. And then, so you're, because you threw out the thing about the evolutionary psychology being right about this sort of lizard brain fight or flight response, but, like, is there where from my vantage point, the evolutionary psychology view does not really give a lot of credence to human nature, like what makes us, what makes us go against our own best interests. And that seems to be something that I've never heard an evolutionary psychologist really touch on.
Yeah. I mean, you could say it the other way, my dear, is almost like they're fully interested in human nature insofar as what nature, the natural part of what it is to be human. What I would say they don't get is what the existentialists talk about, which is this dimension of lack that destabilizes nature.
Yeah.
That's what was missing.
It's the fact. Yeah. It's, I loved when, I forget what podcast it was, but we talked about how from an evolutionary perspective, humanity is a deviation and almost a rebellion against the normal order of nature.
Yes. Yes.
Which is crazy, because it's like the people that are like, we're just animals, man. We're just people. We're just doing our thing. Everybody's out, you know, we're trying to do their, but it's like, when you really think about it, anxiety would be the wrong way. There's not that thing in the animal kingdom that makes people feel, or makes the animals feel, misunderstood or not whole. Yes. You know, so it's
the
so,
lack. Yeah, the lack in the animal kingdom is an evolution. That's the thing. There's a lack in, and some animals may have subjectivity, but most animals, the lack is in is biological, but when it comes to humans, the lack is within the symbolic. And that's the key. That's the key difference, is the lack, that we are destabilized. So in a way, animals are not natural in a sense of there's not a wholeness. Evolution is a lack of wholeness. There's a whole pile of like conflict. That's why adaptation happens. But it's different, yeah.
I mean, in the sense of before they die, when they all die horrible, horrible deaths.
Yeah, which is, dude, do you ever, I got a little high a few nights ago, and I was like running out to grab something out of my car, and I was like, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to say something really high and dumb. And Grace was like, all right. And I came back, and I was like, you ready for this? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, do you ever think about how there's us, and then before us, there were just animals. Before that, there was plants, and there was bacteria, and there were bacteria, and there was ooze. And before the ooze, there was a couple things that collided into each other and made a big boom. And but before that, there was just empty. There's just nothing. But before that, what was there? Had to be something. What was it? Yeah. It was the most basic, stupid, like, but it was just nice. I feel like it's nice to remind myself every once in a while. It's like, I feel like I got a good handle on this whole life thing. And then be like, oh, yeah, I don't understand anything. It's also like, how do you, it's like, okay, so there's the Earth, and there's the solar system, there's the universe, and it's flying through, the galaxy, and the galaxy is its own galaxy and universe, and then there's more universes, and then you get into the multiverse theory and all that stuff, and you're like, yep, I get nothing. I understand nothing. No. Do you think that there's you don't believe in like a soul, right? You don't believe that there's like a box and you're you just gulped. you don't believe like we're gonna reincarnate, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to get that out of the way if people were like, what happens after we die? Yeah, I wonder sometimes, maybe if some, I think there's something, yeah. I'm back on it.
Yeah. I mean, I believe in spirit in the philosophical sense of like, yeah, there is, but it's not a thing. It's,
great. Well, you're going to go to the philosophical hell when you die. What is that? What do you mean?
Yeah. So just remember we talked about Kierkegaard a few weeks ago, and he talks about spirit is the contradiction that is what we are. Yeah. So
that's good enough. I'll take it. We watched, maybe you should check this out, the Behind the Curve documentary.
Oh yeah. You were telling me about this. I want to watch it. Is it on YouTube?
Dude. It's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
And it's really well done.
It wasn't what I was thinking then. Cause I heard that there was a conspiracy theory documentary.
This is, it's about them. It's about the flat
earthers. It's about the flat earthers. Oh, Behind the Curve. Oh, I did see one, but when did this come out? Was it recently or was it a year or two ago?
A couple years ago.
Oh, no, I did see it. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Because in it, you might remember if I can jog your memory, but there's, they get like a device that's like $20,000, laser gyroscope.
Yeah.
And they start doing the experiments to prove that the earth is flat, and they keep coming back with measurements that imply that the earth is rounded.
Who would have thought?
And they do the thing where they go, it's not working. Yeah, do it again. And they just keep trying and trying and trying. And they have the conclusion made up in their mind. And so they're doing the thing to try to validate it. And then when it doesn't work, they do it again to try to make the data match their foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
And that just seems like a microcosm for our whole lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I have a conclusion about how good I can be and how good my book can be or the movie can be and my, relationship can be. And if I'm going to keep experimenting and it's not working, I'm going to keep doing the same thing until the data matches the fantasy.
Yeah. You definitely universalize flat earth. I think that's why the fascination of flat earth, there's something about it, which is both obviously very bizarre, but actually speaks of something that's probably in us all to some extent. Yeah,
that's why I was thinking about that too. I was like, why is it? And even when we started watching it, I was, Grace turned to me and she was like, uh-oh. She's like, don't let me start thinking that this is real.
Yeah.
And I was like, see? I was like, it's like the same thing where I got into one of those, the virus conspiracy things. And I was like, I get it. And I was like, there's no world in which I'm not going to want to have that piece of information that makes me feel secure and whole. And that goes, I mean, this stuff is all connected. It's perfect.
Yeah.
We're all one.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else around language. I mean, there's so much to like. Is there anything else you got in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive subject, and I feel like we kind of
barely scratched
the surface. So, you know, we started off with this idea of the difference in communication and language, right? Which I think makes sense once people think about it. It's like, oh yeah, there's something about language which has messiness, undecidability, mm-hmm. ambiguity built into it. And then kind of connecting it with the birth of the symbolic in our lives, which is the birth of this kind of prohibition. And I wonder if hopefully that makes sense to people.
Yeah, I hope. Well, let us know, folks. And also maybe, I'm just throwing this out there, but let's maybe do another one of these on this.
Yeah, maybe do that, a part two.
Yeah, do a part two. And that way, maybe that can be a little bit more solidified, because I like the free-for-all flowiness of this, but maybe we can incorporate, like, if you guys want to leave comments or you want to tweet at me or Pete, and let us know, because this, yeah, I'm curious what people's thoughts are and what kind of questions they're probably going to be better at articulating than I am. But there's, yeah, like you're saying, that we're just getting to the surface of it. Yeah. And, you know. 'Cause
there's a thing that we definitely should talk about at some point, is that the weird thing, you talked about the signifier, the signified.
That's kind of what something in me is going like that. I want
to key. Because what Lacan does is he kind of starts to separate those, and you go like signifiers can like get loose. And what that means is we use words. So you have a dream about a plane, and then, but that signifier plane connects with something in your life that is connected to maybe your past about flying or fear of flying. Right. But it's like these signifiers are also loose. So words can mean different things to different people. And that gets into really interesting things. Yeah. That's why we get into whenever, if you listen to people very closely and what words they use, often we're basically saying things that we don't even know we're saying. Like language has a dimension to it where I can be giving you advice, but I'm really talking about myself. Mm-hmm. Or I can be talking about my work life, but actually what I'm saying can be applied to my personal life. And I don't even realize it.
Yeah.
Right. The signifiers are all to do with business. You know, I want to close a deal. But then what I'm really talking about is I want to kind of like make a commitment to a person.
And yeah, and you're even unaware of the second part. Yeah. It's just bleeding out of the other, like, the other language that you're using.
So it's not even just misunderstanding. It's that you can be speaking and saying things that you don't even know you're saying.
That's when the dream stuff gets real trippy, dude. When it's like you are learning something from yourself or coming to grips with something that your own brain is telegramming to you. That's so weird, man. Yeah. And I also love, of course it's dreams, and because dreams are so, it cracks me up that you can't help but be bored when someone talks about their dream. And yet it's so, for the person, it's so real and like important.
And then don't even know why.
Yeah. And then you get into the interpretation or whatever, or at least the psychoanalysis version, not like the, you know, Google the dream dictionary. What this means this. But like when my understanding of the dream stuff is going, the dream stuff that's important is the stuff you think is important, which is so crazy, because even the dream you had no real control over. You didn't know unless you're like lucid dreaming or something. We should do that. That'd be really fun.
Oh, yeah.
Do a whole episode on lucid dreaming. I won't get into that right now. But yeah, having a dream, looking at it, and then being like, what's the meaning? And then being like, well, what part stuck out the most to me? What made me feel a certain way? What was going on? What am I reminded of when I think of it? Yeah. And then going like, okay. And it only happens sometimes. Sometimes the other dreams are just weird.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating you said about how...
I almost said real, by the way.
What's that?
Weird, but I think it's almost said dreams are real.
Freud, nice, good Freudian stuff. Nice. But yeah, that our dreams are fascinating to us because we don't know why, but that there is some way in which they're communicating a message to us, and we kind of feel it, even though we don't understand it.
Pete Holmes has one of the best bits on, which by the way, Pete Holmes has a great podcast with Pete. I might have to legally mention that. What's it called? You Made It Weird. Yeah. There's another podcast called This Might Get Weird. That's a similar title. So I get
it. Or maybe that is it.
But You Made It Weird with Pete Rollins and Pete Holmes is very good, folks, if you want to listen to that. But Pete Holmes has this bit about dreaming where he's like, why do we sleep? How would we explain that to aliens? Because it's like, why do you sleep? I get tired. Well, what? Then you eat food. You eat food to give you energy. And then you still get tired. And what happens during that? You just kind of shut down for a little bit. And then you wake up and you feel better. And you're like, but you had food. You had the energy that your bodies need. You're like, yeah. You're like, well, then what happens when you sleep? My brain plays movies for me. Like, yeah, okay. That pretty much sums it up. I don't know why we do it, but when we do it, our brain entertains us. So yeah. Crazy. Yeah. So I guess, I mean, my takeaway from this, I think I have a slightly better understanding, but honestly, I want to keep talking about it because it's such an I think it's very interesting, at least. And I think that it's so, I think it's also core to a lot of the psychoanalysis stuff that we do talk about and that you are more of an expert in. And it's hard sometimes to talk about that stuff without also really having like a simple way to understand the inherent lack that we talk about because it's so imbibed in everything, but and you see it in everything, but having just like a it's the sociological element too of how language arose. I know nothing about, and I think I maybe just need to look into it and see what people are saying, but I know that that's different from what a psychoanalyst would say. It's just I don't know. I want to make it all make sense.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's fine. Like, it's what we do. We communicate all the time. So it's like, what is it we're doing and how are we doing this? And
fascinating. Yeah. And it's such a, it's like, oh yeah. So how do it's well, communication or speaking, you're going to fail to communicate everything you want.
And the birth of the word, I think it was Hegel said, the birth of the word is the death of the world. Like once you start to speak, it does differentiate you from the world. Cause as soon as I talk about things, I'm no longer. Now, the truth is I've never experienced a tree perfectly, but there's a, as soon as you start speaking about something, you're putting it into language, you're putting it into concepts, and it's in your mind.
Yeah.
You're not talking about something in the world. So there's a, it's a very interesting to talk about how our language connects with the world, mm-hmm. right? So it's, which we haven't even really touched on.
I know, it's so great, because it's a, it's like we could have evolved just to see things the way we see things, and we and all of this could be a big veil and a big illusion. And it sounds that's like one of those crackpot theories that you hear. Yeah. It's like the simulation idea. And then when you think about it, it's like, no, it is kind of like that. Like we have kind of made a really big play. Like we've written a really big script for this whole thing. That's kind of like,
I mean, philosophy at its core is trying to get a, is trying to answer that question. So Hegel spent his entire life basically trying to say why we're not caught up in that. He did it very well, but that is the question. His question is like, you know, can we talk about reality, or are we just working with a script?
Yeah,
I think we can talk about reality, but it's very hard to actually argue for why we can.
And exhausting.
Yeah.
That's maybe, that's why we should do a second one, because it's also like, it's, and I get the critics, I think, of some of the psychoanalysis stuff, because it does get so, I guess, sometimes I think it can feel needlessly complex for people. And like, you're sort of piling on and being like, well, guess what? Not only are you never going to be happy, you want to never be happy. And therefore, this is, and it's like, I can get how people are just like, I just want to go to work. I just want to have a good time. I just want to, and that's like, well, you're probably doing a better job at that by doing that.
Yes. So. Yeah. No. You don't want to necessarily get into the theory. The practice can still help you if you don't want to get into the theory, but.
Maybe that's it. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, it takes a lot of work, but once you kind of see it, it kind of all starts to make sense. Mm-hmm. But it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, I've talked about this before, but it does remind me of evolution in the sense of I gotta stop saying in the sense of, but it reminds me of evolution by there's nowhere you can point to it and go, that's evolution. But everything in nature and around us points toward evolution the same way that everything around us points toward this unconscious drive to mess everything up.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's my takeaway.
That's good. What that's good.
Anything?
My takeaway. Yeah.
I mean, you've got a lot of good stuff on this one. You brought your A game.
Did I? Oh, I was feeling I wasn't. So thank you for saying that.
I mean, yeah, that's, but it's a podcast about language and how it constantly fails.
Yes. Well, yeah. So this is a good object lesson.
Pete, not only did you not do a good job, you didn't want to do a good job, and you've had a great time doing that job.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe that's my takeaway. Yeah, because my takeaway then connected to that is, yeah, language is, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, it's slippery. We never quite get to say what we want to say. There's always failure built into it. But that's exactly what makes it so good. It means that I want to go come back. Both of us want to come back and do a second episode, and we'll do a third episode. And the failure that's inscribed into the language is actually then what creates more meaning and more things for people to listen to. And that's part of the nature of language, is this constant kind of missing what you want.
So, folks, if you hated this episode, guess what? Next week's is going to be even worse.
Yes. And that's a promise.
Is the
or your money
of,
back.
Yes. And that's what I do for job.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.